It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, we'll get advice on how to create community by sharing photos online.
First, we're talking about the scandal that broke this weekend. The owner of the Los Angeles Clippers, 80-year-old Donald Sterling, made remarks condemning African-Americans to his girlfriend, who went public with audio of the conversation.
Breaking news just this afternoon, the commissioner of the NBA banned Sterling from the league for life and fined him $2.5 million and wants the league to require him to sell the team. The story ignited a lot of conversations around the United States about race and racism in the country.
It's also got our next guest wondering if it's fair to give what he calls the get-out-of-racism free card to seniors. Christian Schneider joins us now. He's a columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Christian, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, we heard that breaking news, the NBA commissioner fining Sterling $2.5 million, urging Sterling out of the team. What do you think about that? What do you think about this decision, and what does it signal?
No, I think you're going to see unanimous support for the decision, and I think they're going to move fairly quickly to try to take the team away from him. From what I understand, they need 3/4 of the league's owners to make the determination that he has to sell the team. And I think you're going to get that pretty soon, and I think it's well-deserved.
And I just saw on Twitter that there's already a taker for the Clippers. Entertainment mogul David Geffen has said he wants to buy the team.
Right, and, you know, as I said, if the Milwaukee Bucks are worth $550 million, then the Los Angeles Clippers are probably worth about $100 billion. So.
So lots of conversations going on around this. And to back up and get some of the history, if people are just catching up, can you walk us through again what happened?
Well, Donald Sterling obviously has owned the Los Angeles Clippers for decades now. And he's had some things in the past that would have normally triggered something, where he's had lawsuits against him. There was a Department of Justice lawsuit against him for racial discrimination. He's kind of a big landlord, and he wouldn't rent apartments to blacks or Hispanics in certain areas. And in the depositions in those cases, he said some pretty appalling things about minorities. So that should have been a tip off right there. But most recently, he was on a conversation with his girlfriend, who I believe is half Hispanic and half African American, imploring her not to bring any African Americans, any blacks to the Clippers games, because he just didn't like the way that presented the team. She had posted a picture of herself with Magic Johnson, who of course is a famous NBA player, and he did not like that at all. Didn't want the team to be associated with African Americans, and so he chided her on a private recording phone call, which became public and then led to the events that we've seen.
And there was a huge response almost immediately. The Clippers turned their jerseys inside out in protest, and it ignited a lot. And you've been thinking about this. You wrote about how, you know, it's sometimes been the case, at least with you, and you think with other people, that sometimes older generations might be treated more leniently for racist remarks because maybe they grew up in a time that was less tolerant. Maybe they haven't caught up on race politics. So what do you think about that as regards this Clippers case?
Right. Well, even while the Clippers case was breaking, there were these other stories out there. There was, you know, the New York Times did a big story about one of Governor Scott Walker's staffers at the time, you know, making racially insensitive remarks over email. Those emails that came out a couple of months ago, and then you have the Cliven Bundy case, who's the Nevada rancher, who a lot of, you know, liberty supporters came out in favor of, until he made some pretty horrifying statements about African Americans later. So, you know, all those things kind of got me thinking about something that happened to me maybe about 15 years ago when I was helping a family friend. He's probably 75 years old. He was moving from the inner city of Milwaukee out to Wauwatosa, which is a suburb. And after we had done, finished moving everything, you know, a black man walked on the sidewalk in front of the house, and he said something to the effect of, you know, what is that black guy doing out here, although he didn't use the word black guy. And, you know, I think a lot of us have been in that situation where, you know, maybe we have an older relative or somebody, And the temptation is there to try to correct them and say, you know, that's not the type of thing that we say anymore. But, you know, you're kind of stuck in a situation where if you did that, maybe, you know, they'd yell at you and say, oh, you know, you're a young whippersnapper and what do you know? And in some respects, maybe we figure, you know, this guy's living by himself. He's not going to hurt anybody. And, you know, he may not be with us that much longer. What harm does it really do? But what I think you see is in these cases, especially the three big cases over the weekend, are that, you know, maybe we should say something because it's not just themselves that are being affected. It's, you know, all the people that are surrounding them. So if somebody gets in the habit of saying something like that, then, and it becomes a story, then, you know, it kind of rubs off on the other people that they may associate with. So I'm just kind of throwing the question out, you know, is this maybe something that we should start talking to our seniors about?
Well, and Donald Sterling, 80 years old, so if that is the case, that these things have sort of slid under the rug before, that maybe that's going to stop now. Maybe this ruling, certainly from the NBA, sends a strong message about how racism will be tolerated, and age apparently not a factor.
Right, you know, this is only a big story because he owns a team in the NBA, which is, you know, a 76% African-American league. And so that it's obviously a big deal for him. But even in the cases where it's not really as big a deal, you know, maybe it could be helpful to, you know, to have this discussion at least.
Going back to that day when you were helping the elderly friend of your family move, you know, in light of what we've been through, certainly with the Donald Sterling case right now and some of the others that you mentioned, do you think you'd do something differently? Would you say something?
I kind of feel like I would now. I mean, I just, you know, I think we've all been there at, you know, a family dinner or something where somebody says something and we all just kind of roll our eyes and keep on with the conversation. But, you know, I think when we do that, maybe we're really doing more harm than we expect. And so, you know, I would hope that that maybe I would say something at this point.
And what do you think about signaling a change as far as racism that is sort of in the higher ranks? This is a guy with a lot of money, a lot of influence, and yet he couldn't get away with it. Are things really changing?
Well, I think in the case of Donald Sterling, you probably have maybe a special situation. The guy's worth $2 billion. So regardless of what he says, he probably thought, you know, I have enough money that I can pretty much just do what I want, and you know, people are gonna cozy up to me anyway. So, you know, in that respect, I think, but he certainly should have been more, you know, at least sensitive to the things that he was saying, and you know, I think the fact that he has gotten away with so much in the past probably just you know, bolstered his opinions currently.
We're talking right now to Christian Schneider. He's a columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he recently wrote about the Los Angeles Clippers racism scandal, and he says we should stop giving seniors a pass when it comes to racism.
And we want to hear from you. What do you think about this issue? Have you ever been in that situation where you might think, they grew up in a different time, we're going to let what I perceive as a racist remark pass now? What do you think people should do in that situation? And what do you think of this whole LA Clippers Donald Sterling scandal? Are you happy with what the NBA has done? Banning him from the league for life, a big fine, want him to sell the team? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org.
Let's get right to the phone lines now and go to Bill in Milwaukee. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I'm 71 years old, and I grew up in the 50s. My question is Sterling a senior citizen?
He's 80. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. If he's smart enough to make $2 billion, he's certainly smart enough to know how the times have changed. And every senior citizen should be called on when they make a racial remark. I do it.
All right. Well, that's a really interesting perspective. Thank you so much for calling, Bill. Bill saying he's 71 and Sterling, you know, certainly old enough to know better. He's smart enough to make money, and it's time to call people out. As you're saying, Christian, what do you think?
Well, yeah, I think that's right. I mean, certainly there are a lot of horrible people that end up making a lot of money. So I don't know if he's necessarily smart. He may be smart in some ways, but not in others. So, yeah, I mean, my column kind of sounds like an after-school special, how to talk to your grandparents about race. I think he's right. And, I agree with the fact that that we should maybe talk about this more often.
We haven't really talked about the how-to. Do you have any advice about that part of it?
Well, I mean, I would certainly, come at it as gently as possible. As, you know, hey, you may be from a different time, and maybe this is at some point something that you could talk about, but this might not be the way that we talk about things anymore. I used to go over to a friend's house, and his dad was there, and, you know, we said, well, we want to go downtown for this or that, and he says, well, you know, if you want to see black people, then just watch them on TV, even though he didn't use the term black people. And so, you know, that would have been a really awkward time for me at age 15 or whatever to lecture him on racism. But I do think you have to pick your spots, and I think there are ways you can go about doing it.
That's an interesting point. You were 15. This was your dad's, your friend's dad. He had some authority over you.
Right.
But you got to wonder if maybe, you know, to take your argument all the way to its logical conclusion, maybe it doesn't matter anymore. Maybe it's time to say something no matter the moment, no matter the age. Do you think we're there?
Yeah, but then, you know, had I said something, I probably would have gotten a lecture from him, which is, I think, what makes this, you know, a really complicated issue. It's not just, you can't just walk into any situation and start lecturing people on positions that they've held their entire lives and are probably never going to change. So, one of the things that's come up in these recent examples is, how culpable do we hold the people that associate with these other people? I mean, is the NBA culpable because they knew about this guy for years and years? Or, you know, we've had a discussion about how culpable Scott Walker is for his own staff and the things that they might say. So, given, you know, what I've said, I think we should give people a lot of leeway as far as the people with the unfortunate racial attitudes, I think we should condemn them, but the people that are around them, I think we should give them a little bit of slack, because these can be uncomfortable conversations to have.
I want to go back to the phones now. Joining us is Peggy from Winona. Hi, Peggy.
Hello. I worked for many years when I was younger at a service club bar, and all my customers were 60, 65, 70, and up, and I was 25. They had all lots of veterans, comments about racial comments, and I didn't know what to do. I was very intimidated. Nobody seemed to think there was anything wrong with this. Nobody said a word. Now I am 45 years old, and it's an entirely different situation. I would definitely say something. But at the time, I was too intimidated.
It's interesting. So you've changed, and you would speak out now.
Yes, I would. Well, I'm not 25 and quiet anymore. I definitely say my mind. But like I said, at the time, I needed that job.
Gotcha, Peggy. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your thoughts. Christian, what do you think?
Yeah, I think Peggy nails it. I think it's, you know, it, especially when you're younger, it's a difficult conversation to have. But, you know, as we get older, maybe we start to get a little more comfortable, and you start to see some of what happens when these things are said.
Let's go to another caller now. Craig is joining us from Appleton. Hey, Craig.
Hi.
Hi, what do you think?
I think we focus on the wrong things about race, you know, and I'm not at all trying to defend Sterling. The man's a dinosaur. His comments were ignorant. He should have known better. But, you know, we look at race only from that avenue. We're making a huge deal out of a private conversation this man had with his girlfriend that he didn't think anybody else was going to hear, yet do you hear anybody make a big deal out of the fact that 56 people were shot in Chicago over Easter weekend in the all-black neighborhoods of Chicago? No.
Oh, I think we lost you there.
I don't think there are that many people anymore that really care about the color of somebody's skin. They're dinosaurs, like Mr. Sterling.
All right. Well, thank you for your comments, Craig. And Christian, what would you say to that?
Well, obviously, there's an issue of proportionality there, but you know, this is kind of what everybody's talking about right now. And I think, given that this is in the news, and you know, maybe it shouldn't be, but now that it is, I think it's an instructive time to talk about it.
And Christian, in our last minute here, what do you think the way the NBA handled this controversy is going to say to people who might hold views similar to those expressed by Donald Sterling?
I don't know that there are a whole lot of racists out there that have a chance to own an NBA team, so I don't know if it's going to deter them from
buying
one.
Even if you take away the NBA team, though, what do you think it says?
Right. No, I think it's a good message that this isn't going to be tolerated, that even in private, I mean, yes, this was a private conversation, but, you know, we live in an age now, and this is a lesson, we live in an age where everything can be recorded, everything can be video taped, so... you know, it's a good lesson to not go that route if there's any question in your mind whether you should be.
Christian, thanks a lot for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Sure, thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Christian Schneider, columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. A picture is worth a thousand words, and nowhere has that been truer than in the online world, where one picture can stand for an entire story.
Well, taking a good picture is an art in itself. There's also an art to what you do with the photos once they've been taken. On this segment of Teach Me What You Know, we'll learn how to collaborate and build online communities around the pictures we take and the pictures we share.
With us is digital producer and online editor Andy Adams. He's founder of Flack Photo, an online photography channel for people who are passionate about visual culture. Andy, welcome to Central Time.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with the basics. What is Flack Photo?
Flack Photo, let's see. It's, you know, above all, it's a website, but essentially what it is an online experience for people who are passionate about photography. The site promotes photographers, exhibitions, and books. But I also do a lot of projects on social media that organizes opportunities for people around the world that care about pictures to come together to share their ideas about pictures.
So the digital revolution really changed photography. No more taking care of that film, processing it ourselves, or waiting, you know, a couple days till it gets processed. How has the internet, though, transformed the way we interact with our photos?
Right, right. Well, you know, the big concern for a lot of people has been the dematerialization of the photographic print. And that's, you know, fine and well. But once you get over that concern and you realize that images can travel and circulate literally anywhere there's a screen, anywhere there's the web, it opens up a whole new possibility for meeting people who care about those pictures. And so really what's exciting is that as long as you have access to the web and a digital imaging machine, you can share that picture with anyone anywhere in the world.
So you talk about connecting people who are passionate about photos all over the world. Can you tell a couple stories about people who've connected that way through Flack Photo?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a big part of the project for me is at Facebook, like for lots of people, has really changed the way that I think about what I do. And really, it's kind of change the way that I think all of us engage with the things that we're interested in. And so let's see, about 2011, I had an idea that I could found a Facebook group focused on photography. And I'm not sure if you've used Facebook groups before. They're very simple. But of course, we're all addicted to Facebook and use it every single day. And so it seemed like a perfect opportunity to say, come here, hang out here and talk about pictures. So I started this group with a handful of people. And like a lot of things in the social media world, it went viral and people kept sharing it with their friends. As it turned out, 2 days after I launched the group, I was traveling over to the UK to give a lecture about some of these ideas. And it kind of blew my mind because literally in the time that it took me to fly across the pond, you know, 1,000 people had joined this group, and people that I didn't know were greeting me on the ground in the UK saying,
wow.
Andy, is that you? Are you Andy Adams? You know, of course, I have these black glasses and a beard, and that made me sort of recognizable. But that really made me realize that, you know, the web is a powerful tool for connecting people who share interests. Hmm.
So now we don't need a museum to put on a photo exhibition. How can people work together to do their own photo shows and share these themes, even if they're not pros?
Well, I guess the first piece of advice I would say is to embrace the internet. A lot of people over the years have been reluctant to put pictures online because of intellectual property and so forth, and that makes sense. I think, though, in the last few years, we've really seen people of all generations and of all interests and experience levels embracing mobile technology and social media, and the first step is just getting over that hurdle to, you know, to say what's out there. Once you make yourself available, once you use Google to be your friend to help you find what you want, it becomes very easy to connect with like-minded people.
Do you still want to be kind of curatorial about what you post online? You just want to dump your 200 pictures, you know, of a seashell or something up there. Do you really want to put up stuff you're proud of that you think is sort of evocative or tells a story?
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, with so many pictures circulating in the world, it actually puts a greater emphasis on the ability to edit, curate, and organize the pictures to be meaningful for the audience. Because with literally billions of pictures circulating every week, how do you know what to pay attention to? How do you know what is important to look at? And that's where I think certain tastemakers and magazines, editors, publishers, and so forth are still really important. For the amateur, even up to the level of the professional photographer, though, you know, knowing what kinds of pictures work inside a particular digital environment is something that you'll learn over time. And absolutely being selective and learning which kinds of pictures are going to function best for the audience that you serve is, I think, a huge part of the process.
Well, the genius of the museum, the physical museum, is that curation, and something that I had never thought of doing or someone doing until I checked out what you're doing online is, if I'm a photographer, I could just find somebody online and say, hey, I've got these photos. Could you curate me and like help me do my gallery online?
That's really what's interesting about it is, you know, I think there's this tendency to try to pit the analog against the digital and make it about either or. And I feel very strongly that it's either and, that the two actually coexist, that they live together. And really those photographers that are doing the most interesting work are those that are figuring out how to have those photographic forms coexist. So for example, you'll see photographers who are doing projects that certainly manifest themselves as exhibition prints in museums and galleries. The photography book is more popular than it's ever been. But then at the same time, you're seeing photographers that are really pushing the limits of how multimedia can work, how podcasts and video storytelling can augment and complement the physical print, the printed photograph.
By photography book, do you mean, you know, some highbrow coffee table book, or are you talking about something that an amateur could put together?
I mean absolutely anything. People that care about photo books, I think, will understand what I say when I say that the definition runs the gamut. I have the luxury of being able to see lots and lots of different kinds of books, and certainly there are $75 high-end, you know, door-stopping photography books that weigh several pounds. But lots and lots of really interesting independent zines are happening out there as well. And this is where figuring out how to leverage social media and digital communication technologies can really, really work for independent photographers and publishers. Because the web, if good for anything, it's about getting the message out independently. It's about organizing people around their interests. And, it's not for nothing that I'm able to learn about a small press print run from somewhere over in Eastern Europe, just here in Wisconsin, because of the way that Twitter works in my life, or the way that Facebook makes it so easy for that publisher to tell me about it.
Can you give us a couple of examples of different ways people have gotten together online and said, hey, let's put on a show?
Yeah, this is a pretty interesting project. It's a real-time exhibition project called The Swap. A curator friend named Stuart Pilkington has this project that's based out of the UK. It's a portrait project, and it's very interesting. What it's about, essentially, is every couple of days, two different photographers that may or may not know each other in the real world agree to make portraits of each other. They meet up wherever they happen to be. They make the portrait and then of each other, and then they're both shown simultaneously and then circulated on this website and archived for everyone to see. Really, really interesting. And another project that sort of fits that mold is there's an arts group that I know out in New York City called Humble Arts Foundation. Now, they're doing something that I've been brainstorming for a while, and it's really exciting to see someone doing it, embracing Instagram to do an exhibition. And so what they're doing right now is having photographers submit work via a hashtag on Instagram. And it creates this sort of opportunity to organically make things together. And the act of, you know, the act of sharing pictures and telling stories is kind of collaborative in a way because of the way that you can work together to see what each other's doing.
So if someone wants to start participating in say, FLAC Photo, and they don't consider themselves a real photographer per se, but they want to start participating and sharing, what do they do?
Well, if I make myself very available. I love photography, and I love connecting with people who care about photography. I always say, send me an email. Can we connect? If you're out there and you're interested in photography, drop me a line. hello@flacphoto.com. And I'm on Twitter @FLACPHOTO as well. I just say, you know, let's connect. Let's see what's out there. And I'm sure you have a website. Send a link.
Well, I'm getting inspired. I'm going to run an idea by you that other people could do too. See if this is crazy. I have some close relatives who are awesome photographers. I am not. I could say, hey, everybody, send me some of your photos. I'm going to curate them. I'm going to do three or four from each of you. And I could do a little gallery. Is that something people are doing? Something that is pretty easy to do?
Absolutely. I mean, pop-up print shows are happening all the time, but really what's even more interesting is the way that photographers and people of all levels are using websites to mount exhibitions and mobile technologies and so forth. Absolutely. Really the only hurdle to doing what you're talking about is, you know, the fear that you can't.
About the photos themselves, do you have any, I guess, tips for us about how to curate our own photos when we want to contribute to the community, make the photo a thing of power? What makes a powerful photo?
Well, you know, what makes a good photograph is a hard question to answer. It's certainly subjective because I'm going to think something and you're going to think something else. I think, though, one of the lessons that I've learned for myself is really to be critical about cutting away and really thinking about the audience. For an image maker to put the audience first, I think, is maybe the first step in really recognizing how to make a visual experience meaningful for someone else other than yourself.
So, you've given us a pep talk here in a lot of ways. To talk to the photographers out there, what would you encourage them to do now based on what you've said here?
Well, I think, like I said it at the start, I'll say it again. Embrace the internet. If you're a photographer or a creative person, figure out how you can use social media and social networking technologies to connect with like-minded people. Try new things and be open to creative collaborations.
Well, Andy, thank you so much for stopping by and talking about this with us.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Andy Adams. He is a digital producer, photo editor, and founder of Flack Photo, an online photography channel for people who are passionate about visual culture.